The headlines this hour. Yemeni officials slam Saudi Arabia for refusing to allow three fuel ships to dock in Hodeida port, despite securing UN clearance. Iran says its proposed resolution on nuclear disarmament serves as a benchmark for measuring the actions of UN member states against their claims. And British police clash with anti-establishment protesters and make at least a dozen arrests during the annual Million Mask March in London. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Yemen's petroleum company has slammed Saudi Arabia for its refusal to allow three ships carrying fuel to dock in Hodeida port. In a statement, the company says the Saudi-led coalition seized the tankers nearly 3 months ago, despite the vessels having secured UN clearance for sailing in international waters. It says that the country is in need of fuel to continue its public services. Yemen has been mired in war and blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia since 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of people and has destroyed its vital infrastructure. The UN says more than 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, calling the situation there the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Hussein al-Bukhaiti is a Yemeni activist and political commentator who joins us. So we're looking at a situation where there's a clearance by the UN, yet Saudi Arabia is not allowing the fuel to be distributed, basically blocking them from being docked at the ports. Why do you think Saudi Arabia is doing that?
Since the beginning of the war on Yemen, Saudi has enforced a blockade on Yemen, and they have been using the fuel crisis in Yemen as a weapon. They have actually blocked hundreds of ships since the beginning of the war. Only, especially since Biden become as U.S. president, we have one of the longest fuel crises from the beginning of the year, January, when Biden become a president, till now. It seems to be that even though Biden has spoken out and cried out loud about the humanitarian crisis in Yemen and about the sales of weapons to Saudi Arabia, but actually he's doing exactly the same what Trump is doing. But at least, I mean, to be honest, Trump, he was so honest. He was like, with Saudi Arabia, 100%, he was selling weapons without saying at the beginning, we will like study those sales of weapons. And we've seen that in the last few days, United States has signed an agreement or a sales agreement with Saudi Arabia to sell missiles that will exceed $680 millions of dollars. And now we see that Saudi, even though those ships has the green light and has been searched by the United Nations, and they have all the paper with the United Nations, and Saudi have searched those ships, but they are actually didn't allow them to dock in Hodeida port because they have like a green light from Biden administration to use fuel and to use those humanitarian ships as a weapons against Yemenis because they have failed military. That's why now they are trying to enforce more blockade in Yemen, affecting millions of people. And we see all around the world that some international, like the community, United Nations and UN Security Council, they are crying out loud about the situation, not in Yemen, they are crying out loud about the situation when they say humanitarian situation in Marib. They allow Saudi to use Marib as a base for terrorism, for attack against Yemeni civilians. And now when Marib is so close to be liberated, we see them that they are not happy with that. That's why Saudi actually will try to block and many fuel ships to come into the country. And as you know, everything in Yemen or in any other country depend on fuel. Hospitals are running low of fuel. Some hospital might be closed. The entire what's left of Yemen economy depend on fuel. That's why who is responsible for this is not only Saudi Arabia, it's the United States and Biden administration who keep selling Saudi's weapons and as well who keep supporting Saudi to enforce this blockade on Yemen.
Yeah, looking specifically here, Hossein Abouqaiti, at a report that was published and this goes back to the month of April, where it says that the U.S. stance on the fact that the fuel is not being allowed to come into Yemen is not the fault of Saudi Arabia. This is what the U.S. stance is. And it actually says that it's not a blockade and that the U.S. says Saudi Arabia isn't to blame for Yemen's fuel shortage. However, the facts speak for themselves that the fuel shortage contributes to not only the economy being devastated, whatever's left of it, as you said, but it leads to the exacerbating the humanitarian situation, which obviously leads to deaths, to sickness, disease to prevail, etc. That's pretty plain to see. What can be done then to have this situation get better or to have the fuel get distributed? What can be done, whether it's through international organizations or otherwise?
I mean, as you mentioned, what was released from the United States in April saying that is not Saudi fault. I mean, this is so silly. This is just adding insult to injuries. Most of Yemen budget, 85% from Yemeni budget, it comes from the gas and oil revenue that's under the control of Saudi Arabia now in Marib. Before the war, oil infrastructure in Marib, they only produce a small fraction of what Yemen need of fuel, like petrol and diesel. That's why Yemen used to import most of it, petrol and diesel, from outside. And who's controlling the sea? Who's blocking the ship from entering Hodeidah port? It's Saudi Arabia and the United States. And anybody can just look into that app called Marine Radars, and you're gonna see that in front of Jizan, Saudi port of Jizan, there are about 10 to 15 fuel ships that has been, some of them has been there for more than 6 to 7 months. This is exactly what's happening, and silly from the United Nations, especially now for anyone who can search and find the information online. They don't need actually to believe whatever they say. They can check facts through some website and through some of these apps that I have mentioned. And like these three ships that have been blocked by Saudi Arabia, you can just search those app, Marine Radars or other apps that show you the exact location of those ships, and it's clearly that Saudi is blocking those ships. And actually the blockade, it affects Yemeni mostly. Saudi direct airstrike has killed more than 18,000 Yemeni civilians, most of them women and children. But the Saudi blockade on Yemen, the Saudi constant bombardment on airport and port, even those airport and port are closed, but still Saudi is trying to block the work of some humanitarian aid in Yemen. This has actually killed more than 300,000 Yemeni civilians. More than 7,000 are in urgent need of humanitarian aid, according to the United Nations. One child dies every 5 minutes, according to UNICEF, because of preventable diseases like cholera, malaria. We hadn't had any of these preventable diseases before the war in Yemen. I haven't heard of this type of diseases in Yemen or outspread of them. This is always because of the Saudi blockade, the Saudi keep bombardment, Yemeni infrastructure. That's why, as when you ask what's the solution for this, I think that Yemeni now and here, Sana'a forces, they should take a huge step to target Saudi Arabia, to target Saudi Arabia oil infrastructure. Saudi must taste some of the fire that they have actually created in Yemen. If we stay just looking and waiting for international community or for Saudi or for United States and UK to help us, those countries are actually, and as well the United Nations is backing Saudi Arabia. There is a resolution to enforce this blockade. That's why Yemeni forces actually should hit hard against Saudi Arabia, because now I believe, and this is my personal views, that Yemeni and Sana'a forces bear responsibility of all the situation in Yemen, because they can actually stop it. They can attack Saudi Arabia. They can destroy their oil infrastructure, but still they have not taken this decision, and I think it's time to do so, because Yemeni lives matters, and we have to attack Saudi Arabia, to force a blockade on them, to target their oil infrastructure, their port, their airport. So an eye for an eye until Saudi will stop its war against Yemen.
Thank you for that, Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, Yemeni activist and political commentator. Many thanks. Yemen's Ansarullah movement condemned the new U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia as a show of Washington's continued support for Riyadh's warmongering. A senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council says the deal contradicts U.S. President Joe Biden's stated commitment to peace in Yemen. Muhammad Ali Al-Houthi says the arms sale proves that the Biden administration has no real intention to stop the Saudi onslaught on Yemen. The Pentagon announced the sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia on Thursday. The $650 million deal is the first major military sale to Riyadh since Biden took office. U.S. weapons sales to Saudi Arabia have sparked global criticism, given the kingdom's devastating war that has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians. Sarah Flanders is the co-director of the International Action Center. She believes the U.S. weapons sale to Saudi Arabia contradicts Joe Biden's campaign promises and serves no one but arms manufacturer companies.
Well, this is just the latest U.S. breaking of commitments. Certainly, President Biden did again and again commit during the election campaign. He called Saudi Arabia a pariah state and said that all weapons sales would be ended. And of course, that's not what's happened. And this is not even the first. In September, there was a $500 million helicopter parts and maintenance contract that was signed. So this, along with the $650 million on air-to-air missiles, it's over $1 billion in U.S. direct supplies to Saudi Arabia. All the talk about leading with diplomacy and ending the war on Yemen, these are offensive weapons to be used against the resistance in Yemen, so it should absolutely be condemned. And the violation of President Biden promising to lead with diplomacy, and once again, its weapon sales, which benefit Raytheon and benefit the Saudi monarchy, but no one else.
The Iraqi Prime Minister has ordered an investigation into the violence which erupted during Friday's protests against parliamentary election results. Mustafa Al-Qadhimi announced the formation of a committee to look into clashes during demonstrations in Baghdad. The committee will try to uncover the circumstances surrounding the deaths and injuries of protesters, as well as security forces. Meanwhile, senior Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr said that the people should hold street protests against election results in a peaceful manner. In a tweet, he noted that such rallies should not lead to violence and the humiliation of the government. Iraqis have held several rallies against the vote outcome that initially put the Saad bloc in the lead. Iraq's Fatah Alliance said that international observers recorded numerous violations during the voting process and counting. The federal court is yet to certify the final results. Moving on, Iran says the proposed resolution on nuclear disarmament serves as a benchmark for measuring the actions of UN members against their claims. In a statement, Iran's ambassador to the UN said that any negative vote by Western countries to Iran's proposal would expose their hypocrisy. Majid Takht-Ravanchi said that the West has always turned a blind eye to Israel's arsenal of weapons of mass destruction and instead pointed fingers at Iran over nuclear proliferation. Takht-Ravanchi underscored Iran's policy that WMDs, including nuclear arms, undermine global security, and a safe and secure world requires the annihilation of such weapons. The UN General Assembly First Committee approved Iran's draft resolution last week. The Assembly is expected to vote for its final adoption in about a month. Political commentator Lawrence Davidson says Israel is not only an obstacle to nuclear disarmament, but a threat to global security.
The United States will dismiss it as a ploy. They will say that Iran is trying to get nuclear weapons and at the same time trying to promote non-proliferation, and that's a contradiction. I'm pretty sure that's going to be their reaction. And of course, what the West will do, at least the United States, will try to change the subject or redirect the target of the effort to expose their own hypocrisy, you see? So I think it's a good resolution. I think we need to be reminded repeatedly of this predicament with nuclear weapons and the fact that Israel, in so many ways, stands as an obstacle to progress, not only in with nuclear weapons, and also but with international law generally.
The establishment demonstration has turned violent in the British capital, with police clashing with protesters in central London. At least 8 officers were injured during scuffles in Parliament Square. The Metropolitan Police said that 12 people were arrested. Demonstrators wearing masks had gathered at nearby Trafalgar Square, with some throwing Molotov cocktails at the officers. They also burned an effigy of Prime Minister Boris Johnson in a show of anger at his policies. November 5th marks an annual Million Mask March, which draws massive rallies against government overreach, income inequality, and more recently, COVID-19 restrictions. And that does it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. To reduce building sector emissions and improve health and well-being, there is no more important place to start than the home. We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by Cosima Starr and Rebecca Ochong. The piece is titled Housing Buildings Are Key to Sustainable Development. The article has been published by the Asia Times. In the transition to a low-carbon, resilient and sustainable society and economy, buildings and construction activities play a critical role as they are the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions. As a matter of fact, they're responsible for more than 38% of global energy-related carbon dioxide emissions, higher than any other sector. To tackle buildings' emissions and pressing housing issues holistically, it is important to think and act across sectors and engage with all stakeholders. Pressing challenges like climate change, housing for all, environmental degradation, and health cannot be tackled one by one and in silos, but rather need to be approached in an integrated manner. This multi-solving is what sustainable consumption and production, or SCP, one of the key stones of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, stand for. At the fully virtual 8th Asia-Pacific Housing Forum, funded Switch Asia SCP Facility and Habitat for Humanity, taking place from 7th to 9th of December 2021, discussions among multiple sector stakeholders will be brought forward. The Housing Forum, with the theme Building Forward Better for Inclusive Housing, highlights the urgent need for building sustainable, affordable housing through inclusive approaches. Many developing countries must deal with the challenges of making adequate housing available, as well as climate change mitigation and adaptation in their building sectors. When carefully planned, mitigation and adaptation strategies for buildings not only can stimulate the growth of new businesses and jobs, but can also contribute to other development goals such as clean air, healthy environment, access to clean energy and clean water, and making cities and human settlements inclusive, safe, resilient and sustainable. Among critical elements that deserves particular attention is the social dimension, as it is in housing that social inequalities are felt most deeply. Social inequalities have been evident during COVID-19 lockdowns, when the most vulnerable could not safely shelter in place because of a lack of decent, safe, adequate and affordable housing. When we talk about housing and health, no one should be left behind. That means tackling all the barriers in what we call the housing ecosystem. The housing ecosystem is composed by all the social norms, formal and informal institutions, and trends and events that influence how people act to make changes that they value in their housing situations. At the center of the housing ecosystem are people with their capabilities, vulnerabilities, voices and influence. They are the ones who will make changes around their housing situations and who will define and realize the ways to improve their lives. Some Asian governments have already made commitments to provide adequate housing to all. This means homes that need to be affordable, safe and secure, and provide healthy living spaces, comfortable in terms of temperature, light, noise level and indoor air quality. This ambition should be the starting point for any intervention on reducing emissions. In its regional roadmap for buildings and construction in Asia, the Global Alliance for Building and Construction lays out the many benefits arising from tackling the climate change holistically, by putting human needs at the center, considering resulting social, economic, and health benefits. For example, improving access to clean energy not only solidifies climate commitments, but also leads to health benefits and poverty alleviation, as air pollution is reduced and employment is created. Community-based micro-entrepreneurs are needed to build and service decentralized renewable energy installations. The health impacts of switching to clean energy and green buildings are real. The World Health Organization, WHO, estimates that around 7 million people die every year from air pollution. Buildings and household air pollution can significantly increase the risk of both communicable and non-communicable diseases, including cardiovascular and respiratory diseases, pneumonia, stroke, and lung cancer. A holistic approach that puts human needs at the center is championed by the uptake of SCP practices. These encourage us to see all sectors as part of a human-built system that can and needs to be changed when joint societal goals, such as those formulated in the SDGs or the Paris Climate Accord, are not being met. For example, updating building codes to integrate sustainability and climate change can also integrate mandates for non-toxic building materials, as well as standards for thermal comfort, light, noise, and indoor air quality, thereby preventing diseases and improving residents' well-being. All stakeholders must be involved to improve the climate impacts of a sector, and any intervention needs to consider its wide-ranging negative and positive impacts. This is particularly important for policymakers. While climate commitments may be long-term and made at the international level, developing solutions that are meaningful for living conditions and quality of life are immediate and highly local. Since 2007, a program has implemented 15 grant projects contributing to sustainable housing in South, Southeast, and East Asia. The program is also providing technical assistance to Pakistan on developing a green building code and to Kyrgyzstan on promoting energy efficiency in the construction sector. The Switch Asia Switch Off Air Pollution project, implemented in Mongolia, offers a practical example of how building and ensuring access to sustainable and healthy homes can improve public health outcomes, reduce inequalities, mitigate carbon, and improve urban sustainability and resilience. To respond to the increasing levels of toxic air pollution in Ulaanbaatar, the world's coldest capital city, Switch Asia was initiated in 2018 to promote energy efficiency in Mongolia's housing sector. The project is working to increase community awareness on the importance of insulation and its benefits by promoting a step-by-step approach. This has been done by developing an affordable building retrofit of varying cost and efficiency for households based on the needs and financial capacity of individual families. Soap retrofitting solutions can save families up to 70% of energy costs if fully implemented. The benefits of these solutions include improved health, increased energy efficiency and increased comfort, extra savings from heating, and reduced workload from coal burning. Working towards these objectives, the project's team is active on the ground, connecting households with local construction workers, qualified suppliers, and green loans from financial institutions through a standardized delivery model that ensures the quality of the implementation and sustainability of the market mechanism. Capacity building of stakeholders of the delivery model is ensured continuously. Furthermore, the developed technical procedures of the project are included in the construction codes and standards of buildings, envelope, thermal insulation of Mongolia.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The U.S. State Department has approved its first major arms sale to Saudi Arabia under U.S. President Joe Biden, with the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued as much as $650 million. On Thursday, the Pentagon notified Congress of the sale, which the State Department had approved in October. This comes amid harsh criticism against Saudi Arabia for its military onslaught on Yemen. The kingdom, backed by the U.S. and regional allies, launched a war on Yemen in March 2015 with a goal of bringing the government of former Yemeni President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi back to power and battling the Ansarullah movement. The war has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions more, destroying Yemen's infrastructure and creating an unprecedented humanitarian crisis. Well, joining us on this spotlight, we have journalist of the Gray Zone News, Ben Norton, who's joining us from Washington, D.C., and also Director of Global Studies at Wayne State University, Saeed Khan, who's with us from Detroit.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Norton in Washington. The United States has approved a potential weapons sale worth $650 million to Saudi Arabia. This is seen as the first major military sale to Riyadh under President Joe Biden. Give us your views on the deal.
Well, it's a clear sign that when the Biden administration claimed as it entered office it would end the war in Yemen, we've seen the exact opposite. We've actually seen an escalation of the war in Yemen. And especially right now with an intensification of fighting, it looks more and more like the Yemeni people are going to win this war, and the puppet regime that was installed by the United States and Saudi Arabia in the south of the country is losing ground, and this seems like yet another desperate tactic to try to beefen up the Saudi military as it tries to continue to prop up this illegitimate, unpopular government in the south of Yemen. And I want to remind viewers that when Joe Biden came into office, he claimed that he was going to end the war in Yemen. But if you listen to the speech he gave, the way it was portrayed and by many legacy media outlets is they claimed that he was ending the war in Yemen. But actually what Biden said is that Washington was ending its support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, but would continue supporting so-called defensive operations by Saudi Arabia in the war in Yemen. Now, for a lot of us, that was a pretty striking comment, because from the very beginning, this war has never been defensive. Saudi Arabia is the one that in March 2015 began bombing its southern neighbor. It has always been an offensive war by definition. And this is yet another example of the Biden administration, and specifically the Antony Blinken State Department. And Antony Blinken in the Obama administration helped oversee the beginning of the war in Yemen way back in 2015. This is yet another example of them violating their promises. They claimed they were going to end this war in Yemen after 6 years, but in many ways they're actually not only continuing it but escalating it further.
Saeed Khan, those comments that Mr. Norton mentioned earlier in the year, U.S. President Biden, Joe Biden, he announced an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led military offensive in Yemen, indicating that the new administration is planning a more active role in efforts to end the war. Less than a year, those comments didn't age well, did they?
Well, I think it shows meet the new boss, same as the old boss. And in many ways, the boss is really not the administration's. Washington is now surrounded by the headquarters or the branches of defense companies. And clearly what we see here is that irrespective of what might have been any stated intention, reality sets in for any incoming administration as to who's really calling, pardon the pun, the shots. And here we find then another golden opportunity for the United States to seemingly do what it does best when it comes to foreign policy, and that is engage in military contracts. And I think it's rather fitting and timely as to when this is happening. The price of oil has gone up, which means, of course, that the Saudis and other purchasers of U.S. weapons have the cash to spend on it. And if we want to get even more cynical than that, we can say that the Chinese, of course, are highly dependent on oil. They are paying now for that oil. And as a result, that money then finds its way back into the coffers, not of the U.S. Treasury, but into the coffers of U.S. Defense contractor companies. It is a rather cynical approach, but I think that this revolving door image and mechanism is perhaps most indicative of what we've seen in the United States, and particularly in Washington now for several decades.
Mr. Norton, Joe Biden said in his speech at the State Department the comments that you were also alluding to earlier in the year, the war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. There were hopes of seeing a less hawkish U.S. foreign policy, one maybe with less bombs and more actual diplomacy and aid. It seems administrations may change, but some policies are set in stone.
As the other guest pointed out, the crucial detail in this is the role of the military-industrial complex. We need to remember that both parties in the United States, the Republicans and the Democrats, are very consistently funded by these weapons contractors, and especially in areas in Northern Virginia and parts of Maryland, they are key contributors to the campaigns of both Republicans and Democrats, and the Biden administration is absolutely no exception. Biden himself is no exception. And I also think that we should see the situation on the ground in Yemen and the region as a whole. I think it's one of the motivating factors. It's not just enriching these weapons corporations. That's certainly part of it. But also, the Saudi, that is the U.S.-Saudi forces in Yemen, have been losing the war. There's been fighting going on for the major city of Madib, and it looks very likely that the Houthi movement, Ansar Allah, the resistance of the Yemeni people, is going to win. And they've been consistently winning this war despite years of brutal bombing backed by Saudi Arabia is increasingly desperate, and we can see this further in Saudi Arabia's very strange, chaotic policy across the region, for instance, basically kind of declaring war on Lebanon and meddling extensively in Lebanon right now. And we see that absolutely supported. The Biden administration, for opportunistic reasons, claiming to support, it kind of superficially criticized Saudi Arabia. But Saudi Arabia has been a loyal U.S. asset going back until Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR, the great progressive president, supposedly. He met with the king, Ibn Saud, in 1945 in February, and pledged that Washington would prop up the Saudi monarchy in return for Saudi Arabia maintaining stability in the global oil market. So we have seen for many decades this bipartisan consistency, and Joe Biden himself never inspired any confidence. He himself gave a speech to donors, wealthy donors in New York before the election, in which he pledged that nothing would fundamentally change. And in terms of foreign policy, nothing has fundamentally changed. This war in Yemen, which began under Obama and was accelerated under Donald Trump, is being continued under Biden.
Mr. Khan, let's not forget the major humanitarian crisis that the likes of the United States has helped aggravate in Yemen. Earlier in the year, over 300 anti-war and humanitarian organizations across the world, they highlighted Western countries' role as enablers of Saudi crimes in Yemen. Not only were these countries complacent, but they were complicit in the crimes committed in Yemen. Tell us more about that.
Well, hardly a surprise, given that most of these Western countries have blood on their hands from their own colonial projects dating back to starting in the 16th century and moving forward. Looking at Yemen again as being a killing field has occurred even in the 1960s with the the staged Yemen war between various forces, including Saudi Arabia and Great Britain at that time. Unfortunately, the problem is that the United States is not getting out of the way for the kind of humanitarian aid that needs to come into Yemen and to rebuild the country. Unless and until the United States is able to finally wean itself not only of its own appetite for continuing this, but also giving shelter and cover to its regional allies in the region when it comes to Saudi Arabia and others, I'm afraid that the situation for Yemen remains dire. And I think that point that Mr. Norton made regarding the rather tepid response from Congress, despite the kind of rhetoric that the Biden administration had provided early on, despite the statements of the United States holding Saudi Arabia account for the Khashoggi murder, despite the release of the 9/11 report, albeit still redacted, about Saudi involvement on that day. None of these seem to shake the rather implacable relationship that, as Mr. Norton said, really goes back to the very inception of the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States, which again, if I may just make a slight deviation, although FDR did meet with Ibn Saud in the Great Bitter Lake after FDR was coming back from Yalta, and of course prior to his death just weeks later, the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States was forged between Ibn Saud and Standard Oil Company. That, I think, tells everything that needs to be understood as to why the relationship is still the way that it is between these two countries.
And Mr. Norton, on the let's go back a little more on the campaign trail. Joe Biden said, and I quote, "We will in fact make the Saudis the pariah that they are, and they have to be held accountable for murdering children in Yemen." Well, looking at today, the Saudis, they aren't even on the UN's child killer blacklist. How do you see those comments?
It was, of course, rhetoric. What's interesting is that Donald Trump so wholeheartedly embraced the Saudi monarchy that it did a lot of damage to the image of U.S.-Saudi relations. It was associated strongly with the Trump camp, with the Republican Party. So Democrats, for cynical, opportunistic reasons, pretended to oppose Saudi Arabia. There's also a conflict going on, a geopolitical conflict, where Saudi Arabia has been trying to improve its relations with Russia, and there's discussions of Saudi Arabia buying potential Russian military technology. So the U.S. is trying to discipline Saudi Arabia, this country that Washington thinks should always follow orders, because Washington's foreign policy says that every country around the world should follow its orders. But at the end of the day, we see that when Joe Biden might lightly criticize Saudi Arabia, it's purely rhetorical, because what's most important to Saudi Arabia is that the U.S. government will continue selling it weapons. And more importantly, I mean, the weapons are important, but also the U.S. military has been directly aiding the Saudi military. Let's not forget, the Saudi military has very little experience waging war. And we have known for many years, since the beginning of the war in Yemen in March 2015, that the U.S. military and the British military have had military personnel physically on the ground in Riyadh, in command centers, providing assistance. They have a list of, with access to all of the targets in Yemen, and they, in some cases, actually are directly approving Saudi Arabia's airstrikes in Yemen. And I want to remind our viewers that those airstrikes in Yemen have consistently, intentionally targeted civilian areas in Yemen. We know, for instance, that over one-third of Saudi air raids have hit civilian targets in Yemen, and specifically food production. Saudi Arabia, with the total support of Washington and London, has intentionally tried to destroy food production in Yemen, trying to create a famine, trying to use hunger and starvation as a weapon to try to break the will of the Yemeni people and to try to retake the north of the country where the majority of Yemenis live. And this is a policy, again, that I want to stress, has been consistent and bipartisan throughout the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and now the Biden administration.
Saeed Khan, what is Washington gaining from this war being dragged out for so long? Many believe that if Riyadh didn't have the green light from the U.S., this war would have been over by now.
I think Mr. Norton addressed that very, very articulately in saying that this is leverage. We are finding geopolitical shifts that are underway. The Middle East is no longer the unilateral playground for the United States to assert its will. The entry of both China, particularly with its long-term infrastructure investments with Iran, $400 billion over 25 years. The unprecedented penetration of Russia into the region, something not even really seen during the Cold War, means that the neighborhood has gotten a bit more crowded. We also have then this kind of equivocation that is being detected, as Mr. Norton said, regarding the Saudis perhaps seeking weapons elsewhere, including from Moscow. As a result of it, the United States feels as though it needs to up its game to, in fact, remain in the game in the way that it operates with Saudi Arabia. And so the best way that it can probably develop and nurture that relationship is essentially turning a blind eye to what Riyadh's policies are within Yemen. I am sure that Riyadh is saying, look, this is our neighborhood issue, something that the U.S. doesn't want to then find itself getting embroiled into. The U.S. hasn't exactly had a very strong winning record or percentage in the Middle East of late. And as a result, when it comes to some of the humanitarian atrocities that we find and asking the question about whether Saudi Arabia will be held accountable for this, I think that that's a question that also could be asked of the United States when it comes to Afghanistan and whether it would be held accountable for very many similar civilian atrocities that have occurred there.
Ben Norton, we've been focusing on why this war is continuing. Let's look at this from another vantage point. What has to happen for the international community, the UN at its helm, to put a halt to this war? How many more weddings and schools and hospitals and residential districts have to be attacked and have to be destroyed before there is tangible action to stop this asymmetrical war, the asymmetrical attacks that are being carried out by the Saudi-led coalition against Yemenis?
Well, there need to be peace negotiations, and Riyadh needs to accept the fact that it does not control Yemen, that the Yemeni people are sovereign, and that the majority of Yemeni people live in area governed. You'll hear the media say control, but rather governed by Ansar Allah and its allies. And they have created a representative government. It's not just members of the Houthi movement that are in that government. It's a representative government. And Saudi Arabia refuses to tolerate that. And that's a violation of the sovereignty of the Yemeni people. I think there have been in the past, in recent years, there have been some attempts that provided a glimmer of hope for a potential peace breakthrough in negotiations. But I do want to remind our viewers that Washington has consistently played a role putting its foot on the scale to sabotage those peace negotiations. And the most egregious example of this is when the U.S. government carried out a blatant act of war or state terrorism, murdering one of the top Iranian government officials, Qasem Soleimani, and also one of the top Iraqi military officials, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. And I want to remind viewers that when the Trump administration ordered those drone strikes in January, murdering those top Iranian and Iraqi officials, it was also an attempt to sabotage peace negotiations that were going on. This was a clear sign of the United States that it opposed peace negotiations going on in the region. So when you have a superpower, the leading empire in the world, the most powerful empire, going out of its way to sabotage peace talks, it's very difficult to have that kind of diplomatic breakthrough that we need.
And very briefly, if you may, Mr. Saeed Khan, how does this war end?
I don't know if it will end, and I apologize for sounding so pessimistic closing the show. The fact is that there does not seem to be any will for those who are most in a position to end this war to have the appetite or the intentionality to do so.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's program. Journalist at the Gray Zone News, Ben Norton, joining us from Washington, and Director of Global Studies at Wayne State University, Saeed Khan, joining us from Detroit. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and comments with us here on Spotlight, and also special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's program. It's good night for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining me in the studio is a dear friend, Sayyid Muhsin Naqwi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Our question today is a very broad question, but perhaps a question that is becoming more and more relevant in this day and age where we have televisions and mobile phones and so on. So, what are the sins of the eye, and how do we abstain from committing these sins?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, it's a wide and vast question, and also it's a relevant question to everyone. When we talk about the sins of the eyes, obviously we have narrations as well. There is a saying from Imam Ali alayhi salam, I believe, that he said that the eyes are less grateful towards Allah than other parts of the body.
Right.
Means that the amount of sin that happens with the eyes is way, way more than what the sin other parts, other body parts do.
All right. Naturally.
I hope it's clear.
It should be clear enough for the listeners.
That the things, you know, for the ears, if someone talks about, like, do backbiting and we are listening to that, then our ears are doing, you know, some kind of, we are doing sin through our ears.
Right. We need to remember that we are the sinners, but we are using these tools.
Tools, yes.
Right.
And when we're talking, when we are lying, backbiting, I don't know, saying, unethical words about
slandering,
people.
Right.
Yes. So that's the time when the tongue involves
right.
in performing a sin. And the rest of body, hands and legs, obviously, when we walk towards something.
Right.
But the point is, it is only eyes that it moves everywhere.
Right.
You know, if I want to walk somewhere, even towards the sin, it is my eyes which look at the path where I need to go.
They guide you, yes.
They guide me. You know, if someone is talking, I can see them, they're backbiting, I should go away, but obviously I sit there.
Right.
I see my friend, let's do backbiting. Or maybe someone asks me and I see that it's my parents. Instead of saying the truth, I'm lying to them.
Right.
So in all the cases, we see that eye is there.
Right.
Seeing is there. And obviously, other than that, there are many other things. Obviously,
many the things. Because we mentioned the use of
the
mobile phones and the internet.
Use of mobile phone, internet, looking at the non-mahram.
Especially for Muslims in non-Islamic countries, and to be fair, even in Islamic countries.
In Islamic and non-Islamic countries, it doesn't matter, because the culture are becoming same
right.
nowadays.
Homogenous
and,
the culture,
yeah. And the situation in the Islamic countries are becoming worse than the non-Islamic countries.
Right.
So there are many sins that the eyes do. And that's why Imam Ali has said that the amount of sin which eyes does is less than the rest of body. And that's why it is much less thankful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Why? Because, you know, when we do not commit sin, we need to thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Whereas we need to always keep our eyes safe from looking at something which comes under this, under the topic or the subject of the sin. Therefore,
right.
we need to be very much careful.
In
that's
addition,
the first
just
thing.
Not using these gifts given to us by Allah for bad deeds and things, we are also thanking him in itself.
Yes, that's true. For the eyes, obviously, there are many things which we can obviously do to protect us from getting involved into the sin through eyes. Number one, we need to give a habit to our eyes and ourselves of reading Quran every day, looking at the verses of the Quran.
Right.
I have read a narration, it's from one of the infallible imams, that he said that when a mu'min recites a Quran from the mushaf, from the book.
From the book, right.
Looking at the book and reading the Quran, if a believer does that, then the skin of shaitan or Satan starts to come off. And it's only its sculpture which lifts if a mu'min recites a Quran by looking at the mushaf. So there is so much, you know, emphasis on looking at the Quran, at the book of the Quran, and read the verses from there, not reading it by heart. You know, the emphasis which is on reading Quran by looking at it.
Looking
even
at
if a person is hafiz, even a person has memorized the Quran, still the orders are to look at the Quran and read it. Because according to some other verses, this is this action is the one which mostly, like this action basically, we can say hurts shaitan the most.
Right.
This is the
action. It weakens his influence on the mu'min.
Yeah. So this is one of the things. Why it is, you know, why they have said to look at the Quran and read it? Why to keep your eyes away from the sin? What is the reason?
Right.
Why they said you should not see everything? There is a limitations. Why is it so? The discussion will become a bit philosophical.
Right. Okay.
If I want to just go into this.
Right.
And I have to, obviously. I have no other choice.
To answer this question, yes.
To answer this question. The reason is that our soul, we have two things, obviously. There is a body and a soul.
Right.
The soul will get a shape, what we see. According to the Islamic philosophers, you know, there are many narrations that on the Day of Judgment, people will see other and they will fear from each other because of the shape
of those souls. Some will appear as beasts, animals, and horrifying beings. Yes,
horrifying beings, and these horrifying beings which they have never seen before.
Right.
All these things. What's happening is basically whatever a person sees and he inclines towards that, the soul gets the same shape.
We also have this a similar concept, but not entirely. You are what you eat.
Yeah. You are nowadays. It's
right.
Like you are what you eat.
Right.
In the Europe, it's like they're bringing the ads and everything, like on the TV, especially the European countries. They're saying like you are what you eat. So eat healthy things.
Right.
Because if you eat, for example, a specific animal, you will get the habits of that animal.
Right.
Yeah. So you are what you eat. It's a similar like concept about it. So basically, whatever human being sees. Because it has a fitrah or it has a soul inside it, that soul basically shapes into that thing which the human being is seeing.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Insha'Allah, Insha'Allah, you'll find your way.
Therefore, we have many, you know, stories from the mystics, the Urafa, that, for example, one of the famous Urafa was from the city of Isfahan, Sheikh Hassan. Sheikh Hassan was a big arif, and he stopped his son from raising his eyes when he walks in the street. So he had ordered his son that whenever you go out of the house, look at the ground. Your eyes should be on the ground. Don't look up. So this was an order to him from his father. So he used to be very much careful about his eyes. But one day, Sheikh Hassan got sick, and he was moved to the hospital. And this news came to his son. So his son, when he knew that he came to know his father is in the hospital, he went towards the hospital.